Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and a warm welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with just some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program today, the aftermath of the Table Mountain wildfire. Who is this man they call the ex-boer? The Mandela medallions, a scam or a keepsake? And how smarter research can help companies better sell products and services. It's Wednesday, the 30th of April. Now, he posed as a conservative truth teller, but in reality, a discredited ex-farmer feeding conspiracy theories to millions of people, among them Elon Musk and Donald Trump. Now, this has been investigated in some detail by Kyle Kaun, investigative journalist at Media 24. He joins me at the top of the program to examine the story of the so-called ex-boer behind the digital disinformation machine. Kyle, what exactly is this ex-boer? Who is he? And how did he gain such digital traction? And thanks for talking to us.
No, thank you for having me, Jeremy. Yeah, so Sebastian Uster, he's a 46-year-old man. He's currently running a guest house in Gordons Bay. And what we found is that his account has been active since 2017. He gained quite a lot of traction posting about farm attacks and concerns around farmer safety, particularly white farmers. And around that time, you'll remember, Jeremy, there was a tour by AfriForum to the United States. Donald Trump was in his first term as U.S. president at that time, and he made some comments online that sparked quite a lot of outrage among South Africans. And you know, there was a hot debate around that time again. And over time, Sebastian Uster has used this anonymous account and grown it by effectively targeting certain echo chambers on Twitter. Namely, one around Elon Musk. Also, as people linked to the MAGA universe, the Make America Great Again universe online, the American right. And over time, the account has grown significantly through these interactions. Elon Musk, subscribing to the account in December and starting to engage with him in about June 2024, obviously accelerated that process and exposed his posts to far more people.
And Kyle, in your opinion, how dangerous is the reach of this kind of misinformation?
It's extremely dangerous. You know, I think that there are tangible effects that we can attribute to the spread of such misinformation, not only through Mr. Uster and Twitterboss, but in general, if we look at the attitude that Donald Trump has adopted towards South Africa, claiming that, oh, you know, very bad things are happening and the government is arbitrarily expropriating land without compensation and so on. Now, we know on the ground here that these things are not happening. There is a very important debate to be had around these things that Donald Trump is not helping. And when the most powerful person in the world, i.e. the President of the United States, start signing executive orders and making statements like these, it perpetuates this. It cements it as a truth in the eyes of millions, if not billions of people around the world. And the negative effect of that is we will have real economic problems linked to this. There will be, you know, a hardening of hearts in the Republican Party, especially around AGOA, which we were already in danger of losing due to other geopolitical positions.
I've got two questions. I wonder why red flags weren't raised earlier, and what responsibility, in your opinion, do social media platforms bear for spreading the kind of narrative that you've outlined?
You know, so Elon Musk has repeatedly spoken about being a free speech absolutist. He believes that X was too dictatorial in its censorship. He believed that, you know, the platform should be allowed to be a proving ground or a public soapbox for anyone to say whatever they felt like and be protected and not be, you know, sort of remonstrated for. And I think that this is an extremely dangerous situation. Social media, and there have been many studies on this, social media and the internet, I think, is largely responsible for a series of, you know, sort of massive misinformation campaigns that have really damaged people's lives, damaged their livelihoods, and also put people in danger. At the same time, social media is an extremely valuable tool for whistleblowers that has been abused and tortured into this thing that has become, I think, very dangerous. We've all experienced it in our personal lives where a family member or a friend has gone down a rabbit hole on YouTube or on you know, Reddit forums or on Twitter, on Facebook, and they are fed misinformation on an almost daily basis. And for some people, it is extremely difficult to differentiate between truth and lies online. This is an extremely dangerous situation for society at large.
Let's bring it back to South Africa. Is this a one-off, or do you think that there is the chance of a trend of weaponized identity politics, particularly Afrikaans identity politics, coming to the fore online?
Yes, I think so. I think the online social media verse has been very useful for the, you know, a sect of the Afrikaner people who sort of focus on a real issue, i.e. farm murders, and turn that around into, i.e. an influence position or a money-making position, selling fear, selling controversy. And we've seen this in America. We've seen how, you know, these right-wing accounts have gained massive momentum online. And, you know, sort of democratically linked or left-linked podcasts or video blogs are just not gaining the same kind of traction. I think that what this is doing is it is exposing inherent biases and prejudices in people in South Africa that we all know about but often less talk about. And unfortunately, what is being done here by people like Julius Malema continuing to sing that song, continuing to stir up controversy, which is his gimmick, that is his thing. By stirring up controversy, he enjoys that. He gets attention, he gets news headlines, he gets all of these things. And at the same time, it's also touching on something that is actually a very sensitive debate. We are dealing with something there where generational trauma exists around the land issue that has really not been addressed properly by any sort of government that has been in power since 1994. And I think that that absence of a real solution, of a properly implemented solution, has allowed this space to become so toxic.
And Carl, just a quick one in conclusion. As a result of this latest investigation, has there been any legal accountability or local investigation in South Africa from the authorities?
Not yet. As far as I'm aware, that there was quite a lot of talk about treason charges against some of AfriForum's leaders around, you know, their lobbying in the U.S. and so on. I think that those charges are still born. In all likelihood, there's no law that prevents them from having an opinion. But in terms of our Twitterbot investigation, at this point, there has been no reaction from, for example, the Human Rights Commission or anything else. We are, in fact, now waiting for Mr. Uster's lawyers to be in contact with us, as they threatened to be.
It is an excellent piece of investigative journalism. Kyle Cowan from Media24, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Smoke still hangs heavily over some parts of Cape Town today as firefighters have been battling an out-of-control wildfire on Table Mountain. I want to give you a quick update as we approach the long weekend, and I'm in conversation with Jermaine Cardelser from the city's Fire and Rescue Service. Jermaine, a very warm welcome. What is the current state of containment as of today? Under control?
Yes, I can safely say that calm has been restored to the city of Cape Town. We only have certain hotspots, and that could be in Klein Constantia area and like the Upper Tukai area. The areas of Noordhoek, along Oakup, Savef, Low Valley, and even on Boys Drive, those fires have all been extinguished.
Can you give me a sense of the scale of this blaze? Was it one of the worst ones that your department has had to fight in recent years?
Yeah, I think this was one, and it's actually odd that we have a fire of this magnitude so late in the year, in April, almost into May. Normally, these types of fires are prevalent in from December up until, say, mid-March. The last one we had of this magnitude was the one in Simonstown that went all up to, I think, Lincoln Express and over to Newark as well. That also lasted about 7 days. And I think we're now actually on day 7 or day 6, because it started on Friday evening, late Friday evening, around about 9:30 in the evening.
And how stretched were your resources?
Yeah, I think we're fortunate enough for the city that we've got 32 fire stations, well stocked with vehicles. Every fire station's got a fire engine, water tender, specialized appliances. And on every given day, we've got about 240 staff members on duty, excluding the days of staff that are on call roster.
Now, Jermaine, we know that one person was arrested. That figure might have changed. But are you any closer as far as your investigation is concerned into how the blaze started and whether it could have been prevented?
Yeah, that would be, I think the city is asking that a forensic investigation will be launched, obviously by Table Mark, the National Parks, as they are the owners of the land. And the person that was apprehended was actually on the Clove Valley side, just above the golf course.
But more than that, it's just the one person at this point. More than that, you don't have at this point.
Yes, that's only the one person that was apprehended.
If arson is ruled out, are you concerned, or is the concern among the firefighting community that this is maybe part of a growing seasonal pattern linked to climate change, given how late in the year this particular fire took blaze so quickly?
Yeah, I would think that would also be if that is ruled out. Climate change will definitely play a massive role in this. As I said earlier, we're now autumn, we're going into winter, and to have vegetation or mountain slopes alight of this magnitude is almost unheard of.
Just in terms of your disaster management strategy as a result of that, would you have to recalibrate that, or are you satisfied with the way things are at the moment?
Yes, remember we also have the aerial support for the period from November up until I think the end of April. That their tender comes or concludes on the 30th. Actually, I think the 30th is tomorrow. And then we also have wildland firefighters, a crop of about 100 staff members that we appoint on a contract basis to have extra bums on seats for us during this critical summer period.
And at this point, do you have any information on how badly damaged infrastructure was, or would that still be too early to say?
Yeah, the infrastructure, those cost estimates will be made sooner rather than later. But unfortunately, there were no dwellings, formal dwellings that were destroyed. We only had the one evacuation at Wartuk Manor, at the bottom of Oukapseweg. And it was mostly the vegetation that was destroyed. And obviously those vehicles that was at Silvermine Park in the area.
And Jermaine, also worth reflecting, I imagine, on the volunteer force that you have as far as something like this is concerned. While the firefighters themselves did a sterling job, there's a huge amount of community support, isn't there?
Yes, obviously. Volunteer wildfire services comes to mind. We always focus on those people that has got professional jobs 9 to 5, and then they offer up the free time after work to go and assist us in the mountains. And then would be NCC, that's the group or organization that's contracted by the Western Cape government, and obviously Table Mountain National Parks. But a big thank you and an appreciation for the people, the organizations and businesses that donated. At one stage, Lakeside Fire Station looked like the warehouse. You had everything from coffee, tea, drinks, cakes, pizzas, everything. You come in there, the guys come from the fire line, get food and go back to the fire line again.
So it looks like the city of Cape Town had things well in hand, but at any point do you have to rely on assistance or support from provincial or national government?
Not at all. I think we once, I think about a year or two ago, the chief declared a code red, but that was for 4 to 5 hours. That was when we had to find Simonstown. Our resources were a little bit stretched, where we had about 5 vehicles that to cover a certain area. But then we've got the mutual aid agreement from surrounding municipalities, the Stellenbosch, the Drakenstein, Overstrand, Overberg, and they will send vehicles and assist us to go out if there were any emergencies.
And just to recap quickly then, hotspots still are in existence. Your teams will continue to monitor things going into the weekend, but you're resting easy now, right?
Yes, no, definitely. We're looking forward to some kind of normality, some calm that's restored. because every day when the firefighters come on duty, they know exactly where they're going to go and for how long they're going to be there. It has been like a 26, 27-hour day for most of them since the last bitter part of Saturday, Sunday morning.
Really going beyond the call of duty. Jermaine Cardle, so thank you very much indeed from Cape Town's Fire and Rescue Service. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, they were meant to honour a legacy, not line the pockets of investors. The Nelson Mandela Foundation, though, has moved quickly to quash claims that so-called Mandela medallions are a lucrative investment vehicle. So my question is, who is selling the myth? I'm in conversation now with Dr. Mbongiseni Buthelezi, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Foundation. Dr. Buthelezi, welcome. Maybe let's start here. And when did these false claims about the medallions being investments first begin to surface, and what was your concern?
The claims we become aware first surfaced back in 2011-2012. At that point, the foundation had been in a relationship with the producers of the medals, which is the Mint of Norway, since 2001. But the claims surfaced back then, and we have also become aware that more recently there are such claims being made again.
When we talk about the claims, maybe just articulate that for me. What exactly are people saying about them, and why are those assertions incorrect in your opinion?
We understand from the investigation that's being done by a TV program that there are people who are selling these medallions to people as investments that are meant to appreciate in value over time. And we understand that people have been sold medallions and the sellers have kept them, saying they're keeping them in safe storage and people can retrieve them at a later stage when they've appreciated in value. Those, we also have been informed by the Mint of Norway that those are false claims because such medallions were never meant to be an investment. They are collector's items for people who just want to own them, and they are not meant to appreciate in value. Although we are not in the space of producing or selling medallions, the partner that has been given the right to produce such medallions, historically by Madiba himself, are the people who are guiding us on how these things work on the market for medallions. So that's what we've come to understand about how they work.
Are you able to tell me how many of these medallions are currently in circulation?
That we do not know. What we know is that the Mint of Norway had been given permission by Madiba as far back as 1997-1998 to mint these medallions. They were meant to be in a series honoring the winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, and they were meant to be 20 winners of the prize honored through these medallions. The numbers, there was never a limit on what the numbers were meant to be. The Mint of Norway would have to give us guidance on how many have been minted. And I should also just clarify that the relationship with the foundation is with the Mint of Norway, where the foundation, as well as the Nobel Foundation, were meant to be beneficiaries. Nelson Mandela Foundation was meant to receive 1.5% of the value of the medallions minted. That's as far as we know.
Are they still being minted and are they still being sold?
The last ones that were minted were in about 2021. We've been informed by the mint, and there has not been another mint run since then.
To the best of your knowledge, were there ever any endorsements from the foundation that might have caused confusion?
The foundation never endorsed the medallions per se. What the foundation did was give permission to the Mint of Norway. In fact, as I said earlier, the permission was originally given by Nelson Mandela himself. Permission was initially given before the foundation came into existence. Foundation was only established in 1999. And in 2001 is when expressly the foundation gave permission for the minting of these medallions. The foundation did not endorse them. And in the contract that I've gone back and looked at between the foundation and the Mint of Norway, there is no endorsement of these medallions as investment opportunities.
Do you have a clear indication of who is behind this marketing campaign pushing the medallions as financial assets? And are there legal or regulatory actions being taken against those involved?
So we have asked the Mint of Norway, who is the organization the Nelson Mandela Foundation has a contract with, to investigate these claims. We are also instituting from our side an inquiry through our IP lawyers to find out what medallions are on the market, who's selling them, and are they using the Nelson Mandela's intellectual property that was expressly given to the foundation by Nelson Mandela himself inappropriately or even unlawfully. So the Mint of Norway has asked the company in South Africa that they have a contract with to be the South African distributor. And I should also clarify here that the foundation has no relationship with that company. The Mint has asked them to do an audit of what medallions they've acquired from the Mint, what has been sold, and what is in their possession. The Mint has undertaken that they will share the result of that audit with the foundation. And so when we get that audit, we'll be in a position to then say who has what medallions and what they've been using them for.
Dr. Buthelezi, is this an isolated incident to the best of your knowledge, or is there concern that it could be part of a broader trend of Mandela brand exploitation?
Mandela brand exploitation is something that we are quite familiar with. It happens all the time and it happens all over the world. So we are tasked in part with actually stopping the actions of people and organizations that are exploiting the Mandela brand unlawfully. We are in the intellectual property is registered by the foundation in various jurisdictions across the world. And people have to approach the foundation and seek permission if they're going to use anything that is Mandela related, Nelson Mandela related in specifically. And where they're using that intellectual property without authorization, we challenge them legally. So this is something that we are quite familiar with, and it happens in many jurisdictions around the world.
But very difficult to do, I imagine, given the universal reach of the man himself and how ubiquitous the brand has become.
It is quite difficult. It is very costly. We are in constant legal battles all over the world with people using the name Nelson Mandela to scam people in some jurisdictions we've found. So it's something that we are constantly vigilant about and constantly having to address.
What is your message to anyone who may have bought these items thinking that they would profit from them? What does the foundation say to them?
So we are saying to them that it is necessary perhaps to seek recourse, so that if they've been sold something on a false pretense, that they should seek a legal recourse. And we hope that they will be able to find justice. We want to be absolutely clear from our side that our job is to protect the legacy of Nelson Mandela and to ensure that his name is used in an ethical way to advance the cause of peace, of democracy, of justice in the world. And anybody who is doing anything contrary to that should be challenged. And we ourselves are prepared to challenge people who are doing that unlawfully and in ways that are not ethical. We hope that people find justice and they find recourse so that they can get their money back where they've been sold things under false pretenses.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Mbongiseni Buthelezi, Chief Executive Officer at the Nelson Mandela Foundation.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, most companies, I would contend, think they're listening to their customers. But what if they're only hearing half of the story? True insights you're about to hear don't come from polite feedback or endless customer surveys. They come from a deep and real understanding of what people perhaps are not saying. And in that respect, I'm going to talk to Liesel Jonkheid, who is founder of the Consumer Psychology Lab. And I want to talk about why real customer research happens sometimes between the lines and how brands and retailers can often get it very, very wrong. So Liesel, a very warm welcome. And you argue that most companies aren't really listening. They're just simply collecting words or data. Why is that a dangerous mistake?
Thank you, Jeremy. I think the biggest challenge is that when you use data points as such, you don't really understand what drives the feedback. So the danger really lies into not understanding what customers are trying to tell you and where you should direct your efforts in improving customers' experience.
And I suppose there's always the risk that customers will tell you what you want to hear, even if you think you're digging deep. And I guess that's human nature, isn't it?
That's 100% correct. I think our consumers overall have been almost brainwashed into the survey format of asking about their experience. And they know instinctively that it's not really about their experience, because most companies use it as a tool for a KPI or metrics that drive their business goals, but they don't necessarily serve the individuals. So people have adopted the style of just giving whatever is the easy way to get that process over. You know, so they do it in reciprocity and they want to help the company, but they also know that there are limitations to the benefit for them.
So you talk about something called the fight, flight or freeze pattern.
Yes, I think, you know, depends on when you actually engage with a customer and how that experience was, how they would respond. So let's say it's very close to the experience and it was a terrible experience, they might fight. So they might immediately give you a very exaggerated feedback. Like it was, they would use words like it was a complete disaster, it was terrible, etc. However, if you catch them later, they might have had an opportunity to process. So timing there is important. The fight and flight and freeze also comes in, you know, when they want to almost deflect going further. So you call them, you want to talk to them, and they just say it was fine. And it feels like you get an answer, but you actually have no insight in what happened. Because fine is often a way to deflect. So they give very minimal responses, and often they don't even know how to explain it. So they just freeze in that moment. And unless you have a skillful interviewer to go beyond that, that's the apparent insight that you're going to sit with.
So what you're suggesting then is that the researchers have got to pick up on nonverbal cues. So if I hesitate, yes, perhaps in an answer, or if my tone changes slightly, or if I just rush my answer, what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that that is more important than the actual answer itself. But you've got to know how to spot it.
Correct. I think that comes with a level of training and skillfulness of the interviewer, because there's so many cues hidden in the response, whether that pause is just a little bit longer than it would technically be, whether you say you throw out crumbs so that the interviewer can pick it up. Those skills are really that finesse that you bring into the conversation that makes the customer at ease and breaks down those barriers. So in essence, if you are able to listen actively, meaning that you're fully present and that you can respond to those cues of hesitation or on inflection or the frequency of the conversation, you know, the words or the repetitive of certain words, there are a myriad of different cues that one can pick up in a conversation that tells you there's more than just the words given or than just the response given to you.
But also incumbent on the interviewer not to introduce any bias, yes, into the questioning, I assume.
Correct. So the interpretation component really sits in the I think the best skill that I can describe there is the decoding of the emotion, is to zone in on what does it say and then ask or mirror about those emotions to understand whether that is accurate. because, like I say, often people would freeze and just give a response and they don't really know what else to say. Often people lack the vocabulary to explain their emotions or their experience, and they kind of stick to the superficial top level responses. It's mostly because we don't often spend the time to listen. We're very focused on asking questions and the next question, but we don't really listen. And I think that's the skill that brings insights. You have to uncover those. It's not just presented to you.
I mean, this also is applicable not just to consumer research, but everyday relationships as well. I mean, how often haven't I heard my wife say to me, Jeremy, you're not actively listening to me. And I'm busy focused on the television set.
Correct. I think that's the beauty of the skills that we are talking about now. It's really conversational skills. It's the ability to really be present in that conversation and hear what people are saying and what they're not saying. I think there are so much in that space where you can hear there's something else, but you don't unpack it because maybe you don't feel comfortable or you don't give that that sense of safety that you actually care and that you are willing to spend that time to get that to the real answer.
So, Lisa, let me close the loop on the conversation then. What would you say is the biggest mistake that a company can make once they've gone through that process? Hopefully they've listened actively, they've gathered the insights, but it's then just a question of using those insights to make sure that it serves the benefit of the business.
Correct. I think we're focusing on the interviewer and the techniques they should use to be able to get those insights. But the benefit of really getting beyond the surface level responses to business is that when you have a deeper understanding of the pain points and the actual experience, you're, as a business, able to detect early risk. So sometimes people would say it's fine, but they just walk away. But if you have that insight, you are able to detect whether you are at risk of losing customers, even though they say they're loyal. And you can invest your customer experience efforts and initiatives on reducing the churn and making sure that the emotional value is the highest by the initiatives that you implement in your organization. So your aim would then be to be smarter in terms of how you strategically apply the insights and prioritize what really matters to the customers. Where are the real pain points so that you can address those and improve the experience and hopefully in that process build emotional loyalty and trust in the business.
And I have no doubt that our listeners have listened actively to this conversation. Liesel Jonkheid, thank you very much indeed. Always fascinating. Founder of the Consumer Psychology Lab. And just before I go, I can confirm that the Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, is to table South Africa's new national budget, that's version 3.0, on the 21st of May. He's just been addressing a Wednesday news briefing, and this was his first direct interaction with the South African media since his U-turn on the VAT increase last Thursday and follows the Western Cape High Court ruling on the matter on Sunday. Now, Godongwana, who says he won't resign in the face of this fiasco, has been out of the country attending the G20 finance ministers meeting that's been ongoing in the US capital, Washington. That's also MoneyWeb at midday for today. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.